At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. Kit Hog, Penny Hog, Mr. and Mrs. Hog.
Who are they?
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hog.
Buenas, muy buen fin de semana. Bienvenidos to Home of the Hogs, Talk Radio Europe's expatriate magazine. 2 hours of stories, satire and conversation that resonate with the unique experience of your life in Spain. I'm Kit Hogg.
And I'm Penny Hogg. Sorry, I'm just eating a chewy bar.
Oh, you are eating an energy bar, aren't you?
Really hungry.
Increased levels of energy are thanks to the lumber sexual Giles Brown, who's lumbering up unselfishly over there, for fulfilling the call of duty once again. Pengy, what have we got on the show today?
Well,
so you've got your mouth full.
No, it's all right. Well, actually, I've got an extra little treat for you today, darling. It's called a vegan morcilla, if there is such a thing.
I love morcilla.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're going to like this one.
A vegan morcilla?
Yeah.
It's a contradiction in terms, surely. Where do they get the blood from?
Well, we'll talk about that later. And then we're going to be talking about James Rhodes, who's a concert pianist who has made his home in Madrid with some very nice writing from El País.
Brilliant. We look at the fashion for abstinence that sweeps the UK like a growth hormone every January and ask, could January abstinence catch on among us expats? And if so, what form might it take? Would it be the radical option of teetotally dry or more moderately resisting that third gin and tonic on a Tuesday? Our story of Spain today resonates with one of the great European themes. It's about refugees, the diaspora of republicans in January of 1939, fleeing Franco north over the Pyrenees, and actually what awaited them in France. Now, like the hair on your head, a thinning, dishevelled, weed-strewn lawn is not a good look. So, just after the hour of noon, Arbalistas, Palms, Trees and Gardens welcomes Pete Maynard, greenkeeper and lawn expert, to talk to us about keeping our turf green and lively. And we have to say that our motives are not as pure as the driven snow, are they?
That's all right, Danny. I think we need to just green up a little bit. That's what we're going to do. Just takes a bit of time. I do like instant results. So we're going to toss up between turf or seed.
Yeah, we have lost our lawn, that's what we're referring to. And so we do have a motive for talking to Pete.
Definitely.
But we'll be talking about maintenance as well and all things grassy. So that's coming up just after midday. And then during our last half hour on the programme, a special treat. We've managed to persuade the sage of the Serenia, Terence Michaels, to join us. And he's going to be talking about something quite specific, isn't he?
Talking about chronic pain, at which he is something of an expert, how to deal with it and the best ways around it. Yeah. So we're going to do a nice long session with Terry, who's got some very sanguine advice. So anybody you know who suffers from chronic pain, it might be a good idea to listen in to the part, all of the show, obviously, but particularly the second part of the second hour.
Pen and paper at the ready. But before we're joined
and paper at the ready, definitely.
Before we're joined by these erudite guests, we feature a long overdue Tale of the Campo, which includes...
Well, two things, actually. Starlings and bird baths, which is always an exciting subject, but they interest me. And the other one, a rat in the kitchen, or was it?
New trees and tap fittings. And in response to a bizarre garden accident, how to extinguish a small fire that has inadvertently ignited parts of your own anatomy. All good reasons to hang out with us.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Last Monday, the 7th of January, a restart day, if there ever was one.
It certainly was.
Christmas complete, New Year. What are you doing with that telephone?
This is your hat. You've got a lovely hat on today, darling. I've got to share it.
We need a webcam in here, obviously.
No, we don't.
Monday, the 7th of January, as I was saying, New Year celebrated, Christmas complete. The three kings had arrived with gifts and were now waving goodbye. Yes, Monday, the 7th of Jan, had to be the first proper and conclusive day's work of the year. We'd earmarked it more than 3 weeks ago as the logical resumption of normality. Except it wasn't. It was a holiday. Apart from the banks and post office closing, you knew it was a holiday because the roads were laden with cyclists in Lycra, amateur Grand Prix motorcycle enthusiasts, day trippers weaving about after a long lunch, and the camper was ringing with volleys from men in camouflage as innocent birds fell out of the sky. Did I say the post office was shut? I mean, we've been accustomed to that lately, haven't we?
Well, I think in our village, they close just before Christmas, and I was right, okay, let's get some Christmas cards. You never know, we might have one or two. And we went up there on that very day, and guess what? It was still shut. Another holiday. So that's 10 days closed over Christmas. Unbelievable.
And even when he's open, he closes for breakfast, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he opens at 8:30 and shuts at 9:30.
And then has a long bathroom stop about half an hour after
breakfast.
Yeah,
a lot of people have to wait for that.
We've got a bit of a beef going with our postmaster. Anyway, Monday the 7th of January, just when you thought it was safe to go back to work, something called the Feast of the Epiphany occurs. La Fiesta de la Epifania del Señor. Quite what you eat at the Feast of the Epiphany, I've no idea, but I strongly suspect neither meat nor alcohol appear on the menu because enero, synonymous with there being no dinero, is also the month of abstinence in Britain, at any rate. Have you been bombarded by the choreographed litany of abstemiously teetotal twaddle that, of course, occurs every January, but this year more than ever? It's a sort of post-Christmas recrimination. The British are past masters of this annual self-flagellatory guilt. Allow me to refer you to last week's Sunday Times Culture magazine. You may have actually seen it. The luxuriant Gwyneth Paltrow declares she's not punishing her body by a New Year regime of lunches called crunchy spring veggie grain bowls. It's a recipe for indigestion, if ever I heard one, where Richard Branson's personal trainer offers her top 10 tips for a health reboot, as well as an over-60s Fit as a Fiddle newsletter where Lauren Booker exhorts us to embrace the challenge of a dry January. Annoyingly, on page 11, comedian Lee Mack...
Page 11, yeah. This goes on.
Comedian Lee Mack tells us that 2 years ago he tried a dry January, and guess what?
He didn't last.
No, he hasn't touched a drop since.
Why ever not?
Well, he obviously enjoyed being dry. It's a message to us all. And then
Why would you do that?
Kate Glass on vegan fever and the case against meat, followed by Matthew Walker on how to sleep. I mean, don't rush to open that one. You've heard it all before. I mean, he says such obvious things like, don't drink espresso before going to bed.
No.
Really? I mean, you know, it's nothing you insomniacs don't know already. And here's India Knight challenging us to change our lives this January, but just tweak them, because she observes kindly, a dramatic change is too much of a statement, and like joining a gym you discover you don't enjoy, it puts you under pressure.
But can I interrupt a minute?
Please, Ben.
What they say, for example, about how do you know if somebody's vegan? Well, they'll tell you. I think if somebody's on a diet or they're having a dry January or they've given up smoking, you'll know.
They will. They will tell you.
Do we ever keep it quiet? Well, actually, I'm quietly going to give up smoking. I'm quietly going to give up drinking. I'm taking up exercise. Why do we do that? Is to reinforce it so we feel embarrassed that we've got to keep it up, as it were, do you think?
I don't know. You don't want to raise your profile too high because, as Indian Knight says, you do put yourself under pressure. So I think if you're going to be abstinent, then stealth is probably a good bedfellow.
Okay.
But anyway, having waded through this teetotal twaddle, what a relief after all this nannying to find Jeremy Clarkson slathering inimitably over the effortlessly vulgar 6.7-litre Bentley Malsan. But it does make me wonder why every January we have to endure this plaintive chorus for restraint and self-discipline. I mean, I think this is a curiously British thing, possibly because January really is ghastly there.
I think it's a traditionally ghastly, but there's the sales and everybody's back at work and feeling comforted, and you know, you don't have to worry about Christmas. There's that.
Whereas here, actually, January is gorgeous.
It is. It's
been a bit chilly, but it's gorgeous. We've got Pompey Gary on the line. Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Yes. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Penny.
You're pressing all my buttons today. I've been in chronic pain for the last 26 years due to a bad accident. And in 2011, because of the treatment I've had for the said accident of 26 years ago, I'm unable to drink and eat certain foods. And it is a very strange place on the Costa del Sol without alcohol. It is that you see sights.
You feel a bit like a fish out of water or something.
I feel like walking up and down the coast with a United Nations blue beret on, because some of the things I'm getting involved in now involves intervention of the highest esteem, and you need to be sober. But it is a very, very strange place. And if anyone is thinking of abstaining this month or in the long term, it's just day by day. It is very difficult, but then, and I am going towards vegetarianism as well, as I say, for medical reasons.
So, Gary, when did you have your last drink?
My last drink, it's a very convoluted story, but basically in 2011, because of these steroids, it's basically burnt my pancreas out, so I'm unable to accept alcohol or fats, etc. And after a period of time, 2 years, 11 months and 2 weeks to be exact, without alcohol, and when you run a football supporters club over here and you have to socialise on a Saturday, it's very difficult. I digress. I then went for a second opinion in Marbella to a certain doctor, and he said that it was a misdiagnosis, so for the past 2 years odd, I needn't have abstained. And all I drink is beer. I hate to know it. It's the spirits that's the problem. But
let's just get this straight. You do actually drink beer.
I did drink beer, yes. Very rarely did I drink spirits, but it was just beer. And it was in a social, always in a social setting. And I wasn't a great drinker. I wouldn't say I was a great drinker. But anyway, after...
Gary, I have to put you on the line here. Have you stopped drinking beer?
Yes. I tried the alcohol-free, but you just well drink alcohol.
Oh, it's dreadful, that stuff, isn't it? Doesn't it blow you up like a balloon?
Yes, but it is come to the point now where if you put a variety of waters in front of me, I can actually tell the difference between the waters.
Okay, that's good. What's your favourite water?
I have no favourites, really, but Bezoia.
Bezoia, yeah.
There is other bad waters available, listeners, but
Do you know the Spanish the Spanish rhyme about Bezoia?
No. What is it?
Do you know it?
Is it rude?
No, I don't.
All right, no. It's probably not repeatable on air.
Basically, it's day by day, but it does change you as a person, and you do find out things about people which you never knew. I mean, just to finish off, I said to my wife, only a couple of months ago, I said, they're all idiots here. I said, we're living in a land of idiots. And this, I hate to know where this is on the coast. The camper has a certain slant to it. I know are very good friends, etc. But my wife said it used to be like that.
Does she drink?
Sorry?
Does your wife drink?
No, her food is her problem. We've just had a diagnosis before Christmas. She suffers from obesity, but they found out it was her feet. She couldn't keep them out of the fridge. As a few people's heard that joke on here, don't worry about it, over the years. But she has the occasional tipple, yes. But if anything, I used to drive her to drink, but we're both sort of abstaining now. But as I say, to finish off, it is very difficult, especially when in a social, you know. But there was a programme with Adrian Giles,
yeah,
on BBC Charles, a while back.
Yeah.
And what is the difference between an alcoholic and someone that enjoys drink? And it is a very, very thin dividing line.
Mm. Yeah, a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Gary, really nice to hear from you.
And, okay, enjoy your show on a Saturday.
Thanks, mate. And check out Terence Michaels in the last half hour, because he is talking about living with pain, and I'm sure you'll find it very interesting. But thanks so much for your contribution. Bye-bye now. Let's indulge after that. Pengy, you brought in a strange-looking sausage.
I have. You can't try any, because I'm going to tell you something. Now, you've heard the arguments over which of Spain's blood sausage or morcilla variety is the best. Some think it comes from Burgos, others think it comes from León. But what on earth would traditionalists think about the concoction currently being made in a remote village in Teruel? There is a morcilla that its creator claims would be suitable for vegans because it's made using one's own blood. Da, da, da.
Wow, yeah. Sort of auto-cannibalism going on.
Well, yeah, you read it right. The first step of the recipe involves extracting 40 ml of one's own blood fresh from the vein. Now, this guy, Raúl Esquín, has found fame after adapting an old family recipe to create what he believes is the first vegan morcilla. And he insists that it's vegan-friendly because it doesn't involve any animal abuse in its creation. He says it's something that he's been thinking about since he was a child, and it doesn't seem weird to him. He said, yes, I know that humans are animals too, and it is therefore an animal product, but if it doesn't involve animal abuse, then it is truly conforming to the vegan ethos. If you're a vegan and want to eat morcilla, then the only option you have is to make it with your own blood. So his recipes, it's delicious, involves extracting the 40 ml of blood, which is done by a professional nurse who lives in the village, before frying it up with rice, onions, water, and a selection of herbs and spices. The mixture is then made into a sausage before being boiled, sliced, and fried in the usual way. He has encouraged others to make their own morcilla, and he's actually doing workshops around Spain, so you can go and learn yourself.
Okay, so I'm fascinated by this. I'm tempted to say you're having a laugh, but assuming this is serious...
He warns that under no circumstances should the morcilla be shared with another person.
You only eat your own.
Yeah, that really would be cannibalism, he said.
Okay, wow.
On that bombshell, that
stretches...
The imagination.
It does, yeah, really. Yeah, that's left me kind of speechless, really.
Okay, that's good on the radio, isn't it?
You're going to read something from James Rhodes, aren't you, about why it's so good to live in Spain. But before you do, I just have to ask you whether you've had this cold that just won't go away.
You asking me? Well, no, I've lived with the cold, with a person anonymous with this cold.
You know, that cold that puts down roots in your respiratory metabolism, and every time you think you've got rid of it, from apparent dormancy, it bubbles back to the surface like a hydra-headed monster. It sort of manifests in different forms: catarrh head, streaming nose, sandpaper eye, kennel cough, impaired hearing, taste bud collapse, general congestion, incoherence, bad temper, and most disconcertingly, an annoying wobbly voice. That really is bad. I was joined by this...
You're doing it on purpose. I'm really sick.
I was joined by this affliction on November the 29th, actually. I remember the date. Do you remember that weekend in Lisbon when the heifer and I adopted quarantine quarters? I slept on the 7th floor of this hotel and she slept on the 8th floor.
That caused some confusion at reception, didn't it?
Anyway, that's enough. That's enough on cobs. I think I'm better now.
Enough on you. Okay. Now, this guy, James Rhodes, he wrote an article back in May, actually, in El País, which is such a good publication, and you can get El País in English. And the title of it is, "I have no reason to lie when I tell you that everything is better in Spain." So he's a British concert pianist and he's travelled all over the world. And he says, "I've never really understood the concept of home. Beyond a place to sleep and protection from the elements, and it hasn't ever had much meaning for me. I seem to have been running for most of my life, but 9 months ago, I finally stopped running. I moved to Madrid. I came home, and I discovered what that word means. It's one thing to be lucky enough to know that Madrid, that can offer the world, offers the world the Prado, where you can wander in your lunch break to see Guernica and then have a picnic in Retiro Park, explore the Royal Palace, drink a caña in Plaza Mayor, streets that... And it's a whole new level to fall in what seems normal to me but are entirely magical, to see people walking slowly, waiting for the traffic lights to change before crossing the road, which is a first for me, to count the extraordinary number of old couples holding hands, to chuckle at the majesty of Serrano when you can buy a jacket for the same price as a car. And then he talks about the watching TV Gold in a bar as Salvami professionals analyse the body language of Leticia in front of a rapt audience. "You may not believe me," he says, "but I have no reason to lie when I tell you that everything is better here. The trains, the metros, the taxistas, the kindness of strangers, the unhurried pace of life, the frankly alarming ability to insult one another." He's actually talking to Spanish people now. "Forget mothers and sexual acts. You guys can do it using fish, asparagus and milk. It's an art form worthy of Cervantes. The delicious language. Your dictionary is the verbal equivalent of Chopin. It really is the Guay del Paraguay. The impressive number of dedicated smokers, as if to proudly tell the medical community to get lost. The live and let live friendliness, cleanliness, open-heartedness of it all. The Croquetta of the Year Award. Your respect for books, art and music. For family time and rest. For the important things." And lastly, he says, "I've met strangers on the metro with whom I've ended up playing Beethoven. Grandmothers who have made me tortillas and talked about their previous life playing the piano. Patients at psychiatric hospitals who have stunned me with their bravery. And a young kid who plays the piano far better than I did at his age and who I've been lucky enough to give a few lessons to. Even Despacito sounds great at the I don't know what that is actually.
It's a song.
Yeah, at 8:30 a.m. on the metro because it's played on an accordion by an old man who was smiling. And as I watch the other commuters on the train, I can see how contagious that smile is. I spent hours wandering around the Carrefour, a supermarket, overwhelmed by the colours and flavours and smells and freshness, seen tomatoes the size of footballs at the fruit shop around the corner, eaten cakes made for me by my neighbours who, rather than complaining about the noise, asked me to play the piano a little louder."
Yes, that's a stirring affirmation from James Rhodes.
Yes.
And
yes.
James, if by any chance you're listening, it's bound to be. Of course, everybody listens.
Hello.
After the break, we've got our story of Spain.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbolista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they?
The story of Spain this morning is a sad one. It's about homelessness and betrayal. The Spanish Republican refugees fleeing Franco in 1939 now seek new lives north of the border. Cold-shouldered by France, Republican émigrés who fled from Franco north across the Pyrenees only to find that liberty, equality and fraternity, the three ideals of the French Revolution, were not on offer to them. In a modern Europe beset by an influx of refugees, we tell another tale of homeless asylum seekers, one that began in 1939. It comes from Larry Hannant, who's the Associate Professor at the History Department of the University of Victoria in British Columbia. By late October 1938, the elected Republican government of Spain was in dire straits. The government had just 17,000 rifles to defend Catalonia, the last bastion of the Republic. When Barcelona fell on January the 23rd, 1939, hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians, fearing Franco's wrath, fled as quickly as their exhausted limbs could move them to the French border. As they made the perilous trek over the Pyrenees, the Spaniards might have hoped that after 3 years of war, they'd survived the worst. They were disappointed. If war was hell, exile in France was hell in a colder climate. Ill-prepared for a mass influx of refugees and preoccupied with Adolf Hitler, the French government forced hundreds of thousands of Spanish into squalid camps scattered across southern France. The exiles were interned in 15 improvised sites, some just barbed wire enclosures laid out over Mediterranean beaches, lacking shelter and sanitary or cooking facilities. In the first 6 dismal months, nearly 15,000 refugees in these reception centres died from malnutrition or dysentery. If they lacked adequate food, accommodation and medicine, the refugees found that they had an abundance of another amenity, French guards. "We're up to our ears in gendarmes," complained one refugee. "The supervision was so pervasive and perverse that they even spied on us when we had a bowel movement." Another exile recalled, "The guards treated us like dogs. They robbed us, they beat us, they pushed us around. For them, we were just a bunch of undesirables whom they needed to get rid of as soon as possible. But only after, of course, they'd bled us dry." Taunted and ill-treated, the refugees understood that the object of the French was to force them back to Spain. And in despair, some of them complied. On return, they were greeted at the border by the Guardia Civil, sent to prison, or in some cases, executed. By December 1939, just under 200,000 Spaniards and others who had fought in Spain remained in France. The French defeat by Hitler further swelled the concentration camps with political opponents, now being joined by those deemed to be Untermenschen. In 1942, Marshal Philippe Pétain, Collaborist head of the Vichy government, began to cooperate with the Nazi regime's campaign of mass extermination. Jews, Roma, political dissidents, and Spanish Republicans were transferred from French internment to the concentration camps of Germany, Austria, and Poland, where they were forced into slavery, then slaughtered. Almost 5,000 Spanish Civil War veterans were killed at the Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria. Some Spaniards were able to leave the camps in France under extraordinary circumstances by, for example, agreeing to volunteer for the French Foreign Legion in North Africa. There they joined up with Allied units to help fight the Axis forces. Excuse me. The defeat of fascism in 1945 allowed millions of displaced people to make their way home. The Spanish Civil War refugees, however, could not do so. Their country would remain in the grip of Franco until his death in 1975. An attack of the wobbly voice. Coming up next, Tales of the Campo.
At Home with the Hogs, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at SpainTree.com. At Home with the Hogs. with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they? The story of Spain this morning is a sad one. It's about homelessness and betrayal. The Spanish Republican refugees fleeing Franco in 1939 now seek new lives north of the border. Cold-shouldered by France, Republican émigrés who fled from Franco north across the Pyrenees only to find that liberty, equality and fraternity, the three ideals of the French Revolution, were not on offer to them. In a modern Europe beset by an influx of refugees, we tell another tale of homeless asylum seekers, one that began in 1939. It comes from Larry Hannant, who's the Associate Professor at the History Department of the University of Victoria in British Columbia. By late October 1938, the elected Republican government of Spain was in dire straits. The government had just 17,000 rifles to defend Catalonia, the last bastion of the Republic. When Barcelona fell on January the 23rd, 1939, hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians, fearing Franco's wrath, fled as quickly as their exhausted limbs could move them to the French border. As they made the perilous trek over the Pyrenees, the Spaniards might have hoped that after 3 years of war, they'd survived the worst. They were disappointed. If war was hell, exile in France was hell in a colder climate. Ill-prepared for a mass influx of refugees and preoccupied with Adolf Hitler, the French government forced hundreds of thousands of Spanish into squalid camps scattered across southern France. The exiles were interned in 15 improvised sites, some just barbed wire enclosures laid out over Mediterranean beaches, lacking shelter and sanitary or cooking facilities. In the first 6 dismal months, nearly 15,000 refugees in these reception centres died from malnutrition or dysentery. If they lacked adequate food, accommodation and medicine, the refugees found that they had an abundance of another amenity, French guards. "We're up to our ears in gendarmes," complained one refugee. "The supervision was so pervasive and perverse that they even spied on us when we had a bowel movement." Another exile recalled, "The guards treated us like dogs. They robbed us, they beat us, they pushed us around. For them, we were just a bunch of undesirables whom they needed to get rid of as soon as possible. But only after, of course, they'd bled us dry." Taunted and ill-treated, the refugees understood that the object of the French was to force them back to Spain. And in despair, some of them complied. On return, they were greeted at the border by the Guardia Civil, sent to prison, or in some cases, executed. By December 1939, just under 200,000 Spaniards and others who had fought in Spain remained in France. The French defeat by Hitler further swelled the concentration camps with political opponents, now being joined by those deemed to be Untermenschen. In 1942, Marshal Philippe Pétain, collaborist head of the Vichy government, began to cooperate with the Nazi regime's campaign of mass extermination. Jews, Roma, political dissidents, and Spanish Republicans were transferred from French internment to the concentration camps of Germany, Austria and Poland, where they were forced into slavery, then slaughtered. Almost 5,000 Spanish Civil War veterans were killed at the Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria. Some Spaniards were able to leave the camps in France under extraordinary circumstances by, for example, agreeing to volunteer for the French Foreign Legion in North Africa. There they joined up with Allied units to help fight the Axis forces. Excuse me. The defeat of fascism in 1945 allowed millions of displaced people to make their way home. The Spanish Civil War refugees, however, could not do so. Their country would remain in the grip of Franco until his death in 1975. An attack of the wobbly voice. Coming up next, Tales of the Campo.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg, sponsored by Arbalista, palm specialists and tree surgeons, serving the Costa del Sol since 1998. Find out more at spaintree.com. Kit Hogg and Penny.
At home.
With the Hogs.
You sure are back home with the Hogs, and it puts me in mind of a song. Here are the Doobies.
Back to the time when I first saw your face. You were walking across the delta to your cold and lonely place. You know I took you for a small girl, really not quite 17.
at home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
We plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the land, but it is fed and warm.
Yes, and as we scatter our seed, it is that time of day when we talk about things that grow out of the ground, arbalistas, palms, trees and gardens. And right now, joining us at Grassroots is the greenkeeper and local grass guru, Peter Maynard. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Kit. Hi.
Good morning, Peter. It's Penny here.
Good
too.
Morning. Hi. Good
morning. Very nice to have you at home with the Hogs. Thanks for joining us. Now, one of the aspects of a garden landscape that we most take for granted is, of course, our lawn. But like a fine rug or a lush carpet in a room, life without it is a brown and dusty affair, or a muddy one, as we've recently learnt. But before we talk about the maintenance or the establishment of a lawn, Pete, can we talk about the plant itself? What grasses do we typically grow on the Mediterranean?
Well, typically here you want something in a warm climate because there's different varieties. Normally, most people go for the old Spanish Gramma Catalana, which people call San Agustin, or you can go for the finer grass, which is typically down here on the golf courses you'll find, which is the Bermuda, the 419.
Right, so the Gramma is that thick-bladed kind of, it has a sort of pancakey, spongy root that sort of bounces slightly when you walk on it.
Yes, that's the Gramma Catalana.
Okay, and that sort of was typically the grass in Costa, Spain, wasn't it? Well, how long has the Bermuda been around?
It's been around for a long, long while.
Oh, has it? Okay.
Especially that one. The Bermuda's been around exactly the same amount of time, but they're better in the seed and they're better in the quality of the of the grass itself. There's different varieties in the species.
And the Bermuda is a fine bladed bluish grass, isn't it?
Yes. It's for me, it's the best grass to have in the garden. It's cheaper to maintain with, i.e. water-wise, because Gramma Catalana needs a lot more water than the Bermuda.
Does it?
But the only thing is, with Gramma Catalana, you don't need to put as much fertilizer down, less products, but with a Bermuda you do. But in the end of the day, Bermuda still comes up cheaper.
Bermuda
to maintain.
Right, okay, so not only cheaper, but unquestionably, to my mind, more attractive.
Oh, yes, it is a lot more attractive, especially once it's been... If it's been maintained properly, then it is a lot more attractive.
And
it gives your villa or your property a wow factor instead of the Gramma Catalana.
Yes, yeah, which is somewhat predictable, the Gramma Catalana. And Bermuda presumably is preferred by golf courses.
Oh, yes, of course. More for the ball. But you wouldn't find Gramma Catalana on a golf course.
No.
It's too coarse.
Yeah. Coarse, that's the word I'm talking about. Yeah, it is coarse. So unquestionably, it seemed to me that your recommendation would be to go for Bermuda if you were thinking of starting a new lawn.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Because all right.
The good thing about Bermuda is the root system goes down and it penetrates and finds its own water.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the root system down to about 10, 15 centimetres if you've got a good gardener, which means you're using less water, whereas the Gramma Catalana, the root system's in the first 4 to 5 centimetres, so it always needs a lot of water during the night, especially in the summer months.
10 to 15 centimetres, that's deep, isn't it, for a root system, for a blade of grass?
Yeah, as long as you've got the root system, you know, they've got the right soil underneath, because Bermuda does like sand for the filtration and for the roots to go down and penetrate to go and find its own water.
Okay. We'll talk about establishing a lawn later, but right now, Pete, I wonder if we could look at the year of your lawn, the calendar. It's now January, a very good time to start talking about a yearly program for your lawn. Things are pretty dormant at the moment, not a lot going on. What should we be doing anything to our lawn at this time?
Well, at this very moment in time, there's not a lot to do because normally January it's cold. Bermuda, once it goes under 13 degrees, it sort of goes dormant. So it's not a lot you can actually do with a Bermuda lawn. At the moment in time, you've got to go and start looking at the problems you had last year with the watering system, i.e. can I move a sprinkler? Should I change the system? Should I amplify it, etc.? So that's what the sort of thing you should be doing in January, getting your irrigation system up already, because that is the heart of your garden at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at the structure, your infrastructure, particularly around irrigation, it being so dry at the moment, are you watering lawns at the moment?
I sure am, because we had a wet October and a wet bit of a wet November. And yes, I've been watering throughout December and January once a week. Not a lot, because it doesn't really need it, because it's dormant, but yes, I am watering a little tiny bit once a week.
Okay, so you'd recommend that in this during this dry spell?
It all depends on your soil structure as well. What soil you've got depends on how much water you need to apply per week.
Of course, if you've got bad drainage, you apply less.
If you've got clay underneath, if some people just have like 2 or 3 centimeters of sand underneath. And then underneath that, they've got clay. So, yeah, you need to put down a lot less water than someone that's got 10, 15, 20, 30 centimetres of sand.
For sure. Okay, so apart from watering at the moment and looking at your infrastructure, this time of year, it seems to me to be pretty quiet. What's the first period of activity that we should be engaged in lawn maintenance?
That's around middle of February, depending on the weather, really, depending on the warmth.
Okay.
Middle of February, that's when you've got to start getting the grass ready. If you've got Bermuda, then you want to cut it short, get it as short as possible, and start sorting out a fertilisation plan for the whole of the year.
All right. Explain that, then.
Well, a fertilisation plan, you've got to wake up the Bermuda, because at the moment it's in a dormant state, so it needs to be woken up, and that's normally done with fertilizer.
Right. So when you say it's in a dormant state, presumably it's not growing. You're not actually mowing.
It's growing. It's still alive, but it's not doing what it's supposed to because it's a warm grass.
All right, and that reflects in its growth. It's not growing a great deal at the moment.
No. I still cut the grass this time of year, not once a week, but once every 2 weeks when it's needed, because I don't want to stress it out.
Okay, I want to talk about mowing later. But in the meantime, we're feeding the lawn. So what are we feeding it with? This is in February now. This is in about a month's time.
Yeah, depends on what type of grass you have. If you've got Bermuda, you need to try and wake it up. You'd be putting down around about 35 grams of fertilizer per square meter.
And fertilizer, what sort of fertilizer, Pete? You buy that from what sort of fertilizer are we using here?
Well, there's loads of different types. But you do need something with a bit of phosphor in it and potassium in it as well, because you need to feed the roots to get it going, not just nitrogen.
So that would be available at our vivero, yeah?
Pardon?
A fertilizer would be available from our vivero.
Oh, yeah, you can buy it from any viveros, but you need to know what sort of fertilizer to put down. That's the trouble. A lot of people just go out and they buy the normal triple 15. They think that's okay, but depends on what sort of lawn you have. Depends on the structure, the soil structure, etc.
Okay.
There's a lot more into grass than what people think.
All right.
So how do you know, Peter?
Pardon?
How do you know? How do you find out? So you just...
For me, it's by testing the soil, making sure the root system, checking the root system, checking what type of soil people have, really.
Okay.
And by the type of the grass, what it looks like it needs. Normally, I put down a 10-17-20.
Sorry, Pete, we missed that. The wind got in your microphone. Can you repeat that?
Normally, I put down something a little bit stronger for the roots. A little bit more potassium, a little bit more phosphorus.
Okay. So really, moving on from fertilizer, but just to encapsulate that, it's about really, it's a professional thing to say that a consultant, a lawn consultant such as yourself, would look at a piece of grass and say, this needs X.
Yes. Okay. There's a lot of people out there that, you know, they say, oh, I want to be a gardener, you know, I've only got to cut the lawn, I've only got to cut bushes, etc., de-weed, but it's not. It's completely different.
Okay, moving on through the season now, coming into spring proper. What should we be doing next?
In spring, you need to start looking at your cutting height as well. You need to make sure that, because first of all, in February, you give it a really short cut.
Uh-huh.
And then you try to keep that maintained short during February, March, and then I normally raise the cutting height during spring.
Okay, so you can cut a lawn too short, is that right?
You can cut it too short. Depends on the species you have down.
Mm-hmm.
Certain types of grass don't like to be cut too low, and that's when you can actually lose the grass.
Right, so a medium cutting height, and that's good for a lawn, isn't it, to be mowed? Trimming a bush. Invigorates
sometimes
it.
It's good to cut the lawn and not pick up the grass cuttings because you're using the nutrients inside the leaf as a fertilizer.
Ah, right, okay. Do you tell your clients that when they see the lawn cutting still on the lawn? Pete, going on through the year then, we've got irrigation, we're moving into early summer now. Tell me about aeration. Do you aerate a lawn?
Yes, I do aerate the lawn. Normally I do that around about May.
Okay.
I do aeration of the lawn, and depending on what type of grass you have, then yes, I would put down a layer of sand over the top.
And one of the things that we get every May are ants. And
mm-hmm.
and they create sort of major highways across the lawn that look almost like passages through a tropical rainforest. If you're looking at it from, you know, by standing up, you can follow these sort of highways of ants as they move. I mean, we're talking about a campo lawn here. Any comment on ants?
Ants—they are a big problem.
They are a problem, aren't they?
I discovered last year, or this year actually, a fantastic thing. It's called, which I got from Grey Salt, which is called diatomaceous earth. Have you heard of that, Peter?
I have, but I normally use normal products that you get that I get from my company that I buy my products from.
Right.
You can get powdered forms, you can get liquid forms, you put it in the backpack and you spray it on the grass. And, as long as you keep it treated every so often, normally for ants, I don't have that many problems with ants.
The whole lawn would just be sort of marched off literally overnight. So, but this stuff was really, really good. And with pets and stuff, we just couldn't do anything else because, you know, it could be toxic with the animals and the cats and what have you.
Yeah, particularly when we were trying to reseed the lawn, the ants would just walk off with the seed.
Oh, that is one major problem when you do seeding.
Yeah, lumbering on their little highways, carrying a seed three times their own body.
Yeah.
I mean, they're extraordinary, really.
Yeah, that you got to kill them off, but then you got to remember to do a follow-up treatment on top. I forgot to mention that before the summer, you need to do a treatment. Or if you've got Bermuda, you get the bad grasses that come through in the summer, which you can't help because they lay dormant in the soil. They're goosegrass. A lot of people have it,
mm-hmm.
And they don't know how to get rid of it. So, yeah, there are treatments you have to put down every 30 days during spring before the summer to stop that goosegrass coming up through the summer.
Okay.
And you've got the same sort of problem in the winter as well. You've got the annual bluegrass, which comes up around about December time, which in autumn, the end of the summer to autumn, every 30 days there's a treatment. It's the same as the goosegrass that you have to put down once every 30 days to get rid of that, make sure that doesn't come up.
Okay, so this goosegrass and bluegrass, is this purely a cosmetic thing, or will they take over the Bermuda?
They will slowly take over.
So
every year you'll get, if you don't treat it, every year you'll get more and more and more, of these bad grasses, and it will dominate the grass, and it actually fights with the root system of the Bermuda.
Yeah, competes.
So the
yeah.
Bermuda then goes gets worse and worse, starts to deteriorate, and all you'll have is all these bad grasses, which is goosegrass or the annual bluegrass.
Okay, Pete, let's talk about beginning a new lawn. And we've talked about the difference between Catalana and Bermuda, and we're pretty well going with Bermuda here. You're unequivocal in recommending Bermuda. Turf or seed?
Depends on the plot size, really, because turf, you know, turf for Bermuda is quite cheap. You can pick that up around about €3.80 to €4 per square meter. Yes, you will have to put some sand down before, depending on the soil type, and then sand over the top. And you can have an instant lawn within 14 days, you'll be doing its first cut.
Really?
Yes. So, yeah, you'll have an instant lawn. If you use Bermuda seed, then yes, you have to do Bermuda seed mixed with the English ryegrass.
Yes.
Linoleum. Because you have to make sure there's no gaps.
Okay, so the Bermuda seed comes presumably from the supplier already mixed with linoleum, does it?
You can do. I normally mix it myself. I buy Bermuda seed, and then I also buy the linoleum, and I mix it myself.
Okay,
I like to put down more Bermuda seed than linoleum, because otherwise the same problem with the annual bluegrass and the goosegrass.
Sure.
The linoleum, the roots will take over the soil and won't let the Bermuda take.
Okay.
That's why I don't agree with a lot of people, you know, they like, you know, they have nice Bermuda lawns, but then in the winter they overseed with linoleum.
So yes.
They've got a green lawn during the winter months. But they don't understand that during the winter, the linoleum roots dominate the ground. So in February, when you want your Bermuda to come back, the roots of the Bermuda have been deteriorated, and they literally fight for the room.
Pete, having seeded a bare plot, how long will it be before you will get an identifiable lawn?
Well, as long as you put the seed down, you've got 13 days for it to germinate. As long as you keep the soil moist during those 13 days, without it drying out, giving it fertilizer as well, the right amount of fertilizer and
yes.
the right fertilizer, you're probably looking at around about a month and a half.
Really? That soon? You would have an identifiable lawn?
We will end up with a few patches. That's why you have to put down a linoleum, the English ryegrass, at the same time.
Okay. And last question on starting a lawn. Is now a good time to be doing it?
For starting a lawn, if you want to do turf, you can turf any time of the year. I've just turfed the garden in December.
Yeah.
And it looks absolutely amazing.
I'm sure it does if you did it, mate.
For turfing, yes, you can do that whenever you want. If you're seeding, then I would hold back and I'd wait a little bit longer, wait for it to warm up a little bit.
Okay.
I would start seeding around about March, April.
Oh, really? As late as that?
If you're using Bermuda, then yes.
Okay.
Because Bermuda wants warm.
Right. Okay.
Are you doing mathematical calculations? I can see you thinking, no, I don't want to wait that long. I don't want to wait for seeds to grow.
Well, if you don't want to wait that long, you can always reseed the lawn with linoleum first, let that take, and then when the right month comes along to seed the Bermuda, then you can put the Bermuda seed over the top.
Okay. Okay, great. Pete, it's been fascinating. And if any of our listeners have lawn problems and wish to consult you at The Garden Keeper, how can they make contact?
Well, they can either call me on my phone on 606-802-683, or they can contact me on the email, which is info@thegardenkeeper.es.
info@thegardenkeeper.es. Okay. Pete, you've been immense.
Thank you, Pete. Sounds like you're outside on the golf course.
Yeah, are you on the green at the moment?
No, I'm not at the moment. No.
you're having a bit of a day off.
Yeah, I'm with the family. Saturday's a family day.
Good. Hey, have a great weekend, man.
And you.
And thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now. That's all we have time for. Next week, the encyclopedic world of Arbalista spills the dirt on raised beds and endeavours to penetrate the extraordinary mind of J.J. Dedena, the swimming pool doctor.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Is the gorgeous Pure by the Lightning Seeds, which at home with the Hogs means only one thing. It's a warm welcome to the sage of the Serenia, Terence Michaels. Good morning to you.
Hi, Tel.
Hi.
Hi, Pen.
Tell us where you are.
I'm in Galvezin on the Serenia de Ronda, and I'm currently on my terrace overlooking the, I guess you call it the roofscape of Galvezin. Very, very beautiful. The sun is shining and all the plants are glowing beauty. And
you're surrounded by cacti, I believe.
Sedums, succulents, cacti, yuccas, that sort of thing. Very resistant sort of stuff.
Terry, we're going to talk today about chronic pain and basically your experiences and experience with it. Because I think it can help a lot of people who might be know people or suffer themselves who do have chronic pain. But what I wanted to just clear up first, if that's okay, is actually what chronic pain actually means, as opposed to acute. You know, you see it on the doctor's notes, acute, chronic, and all these different sort of terminologies. What does chronic pain actually mean?
Chronic pain simply means ongoing pain. Chronos is the god of time. It's pain that is continuous and kind of vary in intensity. So occasionally you might refer to it as acute when you have a period of particularly intense pain. But that's the two basic definitions.
Okay. Oh, well, that's good to know. Though it doesn't really make any difference. If it's in pain, whatever you call it, it's still painful, isn't it?
It still hurts, yeah.
It still hurts, but there is an important psychological difference between the consequences of short periods of intense pain and long periods of perhaps less intense pain.
Okay.
They have slightly different psychological consequences.
So tell us about your experience. How come you've become able to tell us about what you're doing? I mean, I know, but it would be, if you don't mind sharing it with other people,
not
that might be
pain.
Nice.
I can smile from my world of pain. And thank you for the opportunity to speak like this. And I would preface what I am about to say, Penny, with humility for those whose pain is so intense that any of the advice I may offer here it really isn't much useful. I mean, I think I have to be humble about this because there are pains and there are terminal pains that my comments really won't apply to. But nevertheless,
might encourage.
I would say, what are my qualifications here, Penny? Well, I was born with a congenital condition that manifested as a bone disease in early childhood that melted away my right hip and distorted the shape of my skeleton, yeah, and shrunk my right leg away.
Oh, so nice. But you've got a leg toe. I've seen it.
Yeah, I know. But it's had several operations.
Yeah,
wore it
it's
out
a lovely leg. Yeah.
It's a bit skinnier than the other one, but it's more or less the right length now. But after various operations. But I only mention that because you can imagine if you start at 4 or 5 years old dealing with intense pain, you do have, and chronic pain, you do have a lot of experience and perhaps some things to say about it.
Right, okay. I've got we have the picture. So how does that take, how does that start to happen for you, say, from today? If you, what's your method? What's your number one way of dealing with it?
Well, I think the attentive listener may recall a couple of years ago, Penny, we did cover this, and I pointed out that for me it's DEA. It's not the Drug Enforcement Agency, but a question of diet, exercise and attitude, and if we could, perhaps we could take them one at a time.
Yeah, DEA, I like that. DEA, day. Yeah, okay, good.
I was watching Breaking Bad last night. It's a very, very different DEA. But
as opposed to DEAD. Surely to be, yeah. Anyway, moving
Which episode of Breaking Bad were you watching?
Well, you know, incidentally, I almost watched the very last one last night because, just come to an end there. I think it's 56 episodes and each one kept me enthralled.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. It just goes on. You think, every time you think it's going to end, like when Fring gets half his head blown off, you think, that's got to be it. You
please
know?
Stop.
But it goes on.
We could talk about this for the next half hour. I think it's brilliant. It's Shakespearean in its breadth and depth.
Yeah, quite exceptional.
And there's another series you can watch. Sorry, we're digressing. Sorry, people who are in pain. We're talking about the telly. But after that, Terry, you'll be able to watch Better Call Saul, which is excellent.
Yeah, I do watch that as well.
It's sort of a prequel, though, isn't it? Better Call Saul.
Well, the timelines are a bit mixed up.
Okay, anyway, back to diets.
How therapeutic is watching telly? I mean,
it can be. Again, it's a question of to what degree of pain you're in. I mean, if you're in such pain that you can't focus on anything but the pain, then obviously the television's not really used to it.
Yeah.
But here, look, we better move on because we're out of time.
Okay.
So the first thing is diet, and a little quote here first: let your food be medicine and your medicine be food. That is my approach over the years has been to try and avoid chemical drugs because of the unfortunate consequences they have, things like your internal organs, the liver, hi to Gary, incidentally, who telephoned you earlier and spoke of the consequences of misdiagnosis and of taking very caustic and dangerous drugs that may not necessarily do any good. I'm not a doctor, I'm not saying if your doctors have prescribed you these things, but do the research and find out what the long-term consequences are. And I would say that if you are in chronic pain, forget them because they're not going to do you any good over a long term. The damage they do to the other parts of your system is going to be such that you're not going to get much benefit from them. So what you've got to do, you have to do it with diet.
Okay.
And, so you're keeping the tramadol at arm's length.
According to the chief medical officer in Britain, about 30% of people who take opioid drugs benefit from them. The other 70% don't. So if you are in that 30%, then take them by all means if they help you. But do be very aware that I think something like 70,000 people a year at the moment are dying in the States of opioid overdoses. It's so easy to overdose on. And in fact, June 3 years ago, I almost died. On fentanyl. This is the one that killed Prince. So
really?
I'm very, very put off. Chemical drugs, because I have developed systems whereby I simply don't need them.
Okay, so let's stick to it.
Can I just ask you? You are being prescribed fentanyl. You didn't get it on the black market or anything.
No, I was prescribed it. This is before. I think about 3.5 years ago that I finally decided no more chemical drugs, because that was the one that was finally prescribed to me after an escalation. You start off
by a medical expert, by a doctor. Presumably.
Yes, indeed, but up to a point of representative of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, all I found from the system was I was escalated on increasingly caustic drugs that just made me worse and worse and didn't really help. I mean, where there was pain relief, the side effects were so bad that, it wasn't worth the pain relief. So
let's go back to diet, Terry, because I think it's probably best if we steer away from that, because we're not doctors, but we're offering an alternative.
Exactly that, Penny. Well, okay. Said, that has to be emphasised, doesn't it? So the main thing, a lot of pain comes from inflammation. And I think, really, if you can develop yourself an anti-inflammatory diet, you're going to do yourself an awful lot of good.
Okay. How do you know what to do?
Well, unfortunately, again, all this information is available, Pen, but generally speaking, it involves lots of fruit, lots of vegetables, whole grains, and the avoidance of, I hate to say it, if you do like dairy, animal products, but they do tend to cause inflammation in the system. So I've found over the years it's best to avoid meat, dairy, processed food, this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that can be quite a drastic change for somebody. Just suddenly, you're not going to have any meat, no dairy. Blah, blah, blah. That's a big, big ask of somebody who's thinking to do a switch from.
Indeed, it is, Penny. It's not something to be done overnight, obviously. But what you have to ask yourself is, how can I deal with this pain and live a life that's worth living? And I think I've found my. I say it's only my own personal experience, but mm-hmm. but if I'm overloaded with certain foods, I feel miserable. They add to the pain. I'm not explaining it terribly well, but
you are.
To a certain extent, though, the diet thing is one of experimentation, that you take responsibility for finding out what you put into your body and what it does to that body.
That's absolutely the case, and I think you've hit upon a very important issue there. That I mentioned the guys in the white coats earlier. I don't mean to denigrate them; they do a wonderful job. And if you have a car accident or something, fabulous. But there's nothing quite like taking personal responsibility for your own situation in a case like this, and that means looking at your diet, looking at your lifestyle, looking at your exercise, and so forth. And true, it is a huge change, but. Do you want to live in pain or not?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to avoid the pain, you have to make the changes.
But I think it's a lot easier to take a pill than to change your diet.
Of course it is, Penny, but the long-term consequences of the pill are negative, whereas the change of diet, the long-term consequences are positive.
Okay.
Generally speaking. But for instance, I mean, lots of herbs and spices and other chemicals, compounds are that you can use. I use a paste made of turmeric, ginger, cayenne pepper, garlic, olive oil and a little bit of salt, all blended together. I have a teaspoonful of that 3 times a day, and that is marvellous for reducing inflammation, arthritic pains.
You have to send us the recipe.
That you've distilled yourself through trial and error.
Through trial and error, absolutely, yeah. I make up a big batch every 3 or 4 weeks, and I use it entirely in place of things like tramadol, Lyrica, all the non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs and so forth, the pregabalinas. These are all drugs available from your doctor that do have their place. We agree with this, but not perhaps to be used on a permanent basis, as I said, for the consequences of the rest of your system.
Okay, Terry, can I
Lots
ask you
herbs.
Something? So with diet, because I'm on a quite strict diet myself, but for many years before I knew what I should or shouldn't take, it was
just a mystery. You know, you'd wake up feeling a little bit rough or absolutely ghastly. One would think, was it this? Was it that? Was it that potato? Was it that piece of chocolate? Why do I feel so ghastly? What has occurred? And I think for a lot of people, it's the mystery and the time and effort to work it out yourself alone.
The good days and the bad days is what you're saying, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Of course, it is very difficult to sort of decide whether that or this did the problem. But I think with many years of experience, you do certainly find it. And there are some very broad rules that you can look at.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you will know that alcohol, nicotine, caffeine, and bad news, all of these things are going to put pressure on your system, which again, they're lovely. You know, I sound like a horribly pious person here. I used to love my alcohol and my nicotine and my caffeine, and I've been pickled in them all my life. But eventually got to the point where I realized that these things, along, as I said earlier, with things like meat in my diet, dairy products in my diet, all these things are adding to the load upon my system, and my system just wasn't happy with that because it was already dealing with, you know, all the consequences of the pain I was in.
So do you think then, so once one system gets used to a new diet, if you go back to something you shouldn't really eat, the reaction is stronger?
Absolutely, and that's an excellent way of finding out. Yeah, drop it for a couple of weeks, go back to it, and if you find that you've got bad reaction, then you'll know that was doing harm. I mean, but there are some certain culprits that are very obvious, highly processed foods of any sort, white sugar, processed flours, you know, all these things are going to cause problems here.
Can I just say something that I think can be really valuable, and that's muscle testing or kinesiology. Have you ever had that, Terry?
Never, Ben, no.
It's really, really good. And again, you know, people out there, we're not experts, but kinesiology is basically, it's muscle testing. Is very, very straightforward, and there's practitioners everywhere, but you need to get somebody who has the right qualifications. And what it basically means is that you can have a piece of cheese, which or a piece of a block of ice, for example, and you are tested to see what type of foods you are allergic to or what is going to cause a reaction. So it's really odd. You lie down and you have the practitioner will have a tiny little test tube with that product, say the cheese in it. You don't know what that is. And you push your hand or her against his or her hand to and they will have set up a little bit of a circuit within your own body. And if that cheese, which they'll just place on your sternum or wherever, you have an allergy to or you react badly to, your muscles will go completely weak.
How interesting.
It really, really is. And I remember I had this done once and I could not press back against his hand. I was like, what's that? And he said, chocolate. And I just give it another go, and I could not push against his hand. It was so annoying.
Maybe I'll get round to that one day. But can we?
Of course. Yes.
Knowing how time whizzes away on the show,
it's whizzing away.
We've covered very loosely diet, and obviously very important. I should quickly add to the comment there that there are a lot of very useful herbs available that don't do damage to the body. I would include devil's claw, valerian, calendula, chamomile. These are all wonderful things. A lot of people are getting a lot of success with CBD oil, and with or without THC in it. And for me, I use a lot of that, and I find that really is very important. But leaving diet to one side, we want to go on now to exercise. And this is another absolutely fundamental part of the DEA. You remember that, Penny?
Yes.
Diet, exercise, attitude.
I can remember that.
You can remember that. Okay, there is, when you're in pain, chronic pain, there is a great temptation to seize up, to sit and do nothing, just to hold your head in your hands. This is the wrong way to go. You just got to move. And I heard a rather boring but accurate comment the other day. Motion is lotion. Motion is lotion. You've got to keep moving. And there are all sorts of things you do. So now you're going to have limitations to what you can do. So you work within your limitations. But there are certain things that everybody can do. And I would point out particularly breath, movement of any sort, yoga, and then
I can feel lots of people breathing in now. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I can breathe, yes.
do you know, Penny, that as you contract and expand muscles, including your diaphragm muscle, you're pumping lymph all around your body? The lymph system doesn't have a heart. Your body relies on the muscles to pump it around the system. And so the more stretching you can do, I call it yoga, that's a bit grand, but let's just call it stretching exercises. The more you can do, the better. This will pump beneficial substances all around your body. And, of course, breath, the extra oxygen, etc. Very, very focusing.
And breath is something that, well, we have to do if we're alive. Isn't it? So you can be majorly incapacitated, but exercise via breath, and there's ways of breathing that are extraordinary. It's a whole new world, isn't it? Breath.
Point.
And I have a little note here actually saying Kit's technique, because we spoke, I think, some years ago, Kit, about a technique you'd learned for a breath technique for pain control. I think any woman who's about to have a baby will tell you, they tell you, breathe. So very, very important.
Doesn't help a bit, but yes, the thought's nice. It's a load of rubbish.
Anyway, moving on, exercise. Yeah. So I think the bullet point here is you do as much as you can within the confines of your ability. Always push the envelope. But we did a little thing about an electric bike a few weeks ago, and that's something I highly recommend. If you can do cycling or swimming of any sort, that's going to help keep you strong and tough and able to resist the pains of the night.
Yes, or just get up and down the stairs. If you could just start literally a step at a time.
Whatever is within your capabilities, this is absolutely the case. And the important thing to remember that motion is lotion. When you sit, you know, death is stillness and rigidity. Life is movement and action. So keep moving as far as you can, obviously, you know, within your limitations. So that's diet covered a little bit, exercise covered a little bit. But I think the most important thing, Kit and Penny, is attitude. Because
attitude.
Above all else, you can exercise yourself till you're blue in the face. You can eat, you know, nothing but manna from heaven. It doesn't matter if you've got the wrong attitude. So I think...
How do you make the right attitude if you're feeling miserable as sin? Like, oh, why me? How can you get that attitude?
How do you cultivate positivity?
This is how it connects with the diet and the exercise very much.
Okay.
So much depression is really caused by poor diet and lack of exercise. So you can give yourself a fighting chance. You can give your a boost to your attitude straight away. We all know it, don't we? You know, you're feeling a bit miserable, a bit flat. You get out for a nice walk. You come home, you feel better. It's simple.
I mean, they have found recently there's definitely a link between sort of gut health and clinical depression, haven't they?
Very much so, and that's why it's so important, going back to my turmeric, ginger and garlic paste, that keeps my intestinal flora and fauna in very good order, and that gives me a fighting chance straight away, in spite maybe of a night of terrible pain. I can still face the day with a smile, because the rest of my system is strong.
Okay,
that's what it's all about, really. You're not a collection of parts, you're a system, and if you keep the system in good order, if you get a defect in one part, in my case it's the neck and hip, it can be support to an extent by the rest of your body. So the thing I really want to get across here is that you can darken your world by focusing on the negative, or you can brighten it by focusing on the positive. So really, focus is extremely important. You come to the realization, if you cannot change a situation, you must revise and alter your attitude to that situation.
Because you can change that.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think it practices as much as anything else. There are very various points to be raised, though. One is that there's an odd psychological reaction to chronic pain as you start to hate yourself. You are the cause of your pain. And so it's very important to be as kind to yourself as you can. Charity begins at home, and that means being charitable, to try and look at the child within you and suffering.
Can I interrupt you there, Terry? How does that equate with responsibility, that self-recrimination, that self-blame? We're talking about taking responsibility. That feels to me like the responsibility, you've taken it too far somehow, that the responsibility is you feel so responsible that it's become a negative thing. It's no longer supporting you.
Well, that's fascinating.
And like an immune system that's turned back on itself. A perversion of responsibility, almost, that when you start to blame yourself for your predicament.
I think it's something that happens at a very subconscious level, though, but you don't consciously blame yourself, obviously. I think it's a subconscious thing, Killian. And, you know, with a clear view of the situation, you stop blaming yourself because you say it's not your fault. That's what I mean about really trying to look at the child inside yourself. And you know, you wouldn't be angry with a child in pain, so don't be angry with yourself in pain. Charity begins at home. The second point I'd like to make is that if you can't go around something, if the pain is very intense, there is a time when you just simply have to focus on it. You know, you can't go around it, you can't go above it, you can't go below it. Sometimes you just have to go through it. So drop your resistance to it. Fully focus on it. If it's shouting at you, it must be heeded. So you give it your maximum presence. And curiously enough, that can sort of dissolve the pain by focusing on it rather than trying to focus away from it.
Okay, so you're talking about surrender, really, aren't you?
Well, this comes to the bullet point, Kit, really. It's all about, the end of the day, it really is all about surrender. It's all about, if you can't change the situation, you simply...
Yeah, and I'm talking about those intense periods where it's driving you mad and you could top yourself. this is sort of on the brink.
Well, in my case, Kit, that does manifest maybe every 24 hours or so. I get, especially when I lay down or when I sit up, because the change in the angle of the bones crashes down on the nerves, and the pain can leave me quite literally weeping. But I know that it's only going to be 10 or 15 minutes, and if I can get through that, then I know that through the other end of it there will be
10 or 15 minutes every day where you could be topping yourself, but you know it's going to pass. You know that
it's going to pass. That's one of the reasons, one of the things about having had an awful lot of practice for this.
Yes, doing great.
Yes, it's important to understand that it will pass. And I think at the same time you can focus very much on your alternative. And what is your alternative? If you have intractable pain that no doctor can help you with and no drug can help you with, what is your alternative? It's death. And I think keeping it by my side has made my life all the more intense and enjoyable, because I have my alternative. You know, it's always there. It's always available to me. But today, I'm not going to take it.
And well, I'm glad about that, Terry. Yeah. Glad about that, yeah.
Well, you know, it does push...
The ultimate choice, really, eh?
It's the ultimate choice. We all have pain of various sorts. And I'm talking about intense physical pain, but my heart goes out to those who suffer intense emotional pain. But we all have this choice. And every day that you don't take it, it's got to be a fabulous day, hasn't it?
It has. From your terrace in Galsine.
Terry, talking of which, do you have a joke for us?
Loads.
No. This could cause me to take the death option.
Try and find a nice one, yeah.
How about this one? I usually meet my girlfriend at 12:59 because I like that one-to-one time.
Tremendous.
My wife told me sex is better on holiday. That wasn't a nice postcard to get, was it? as a kid, I was made to walk the plank. We couldn't afford a dog.
Very good.
We've got time for one more?
Inevitably.
Come on, then. Okay, well, this is Milton Jones, and actually one of my favourite jokes of all time. About a month before my grandfather died, we covered his back with lard. After that, he went downhill very quickly.
Terry, it's been absolutely lovely having you. It's been too long as well. Will you come back and talk to us again?
I get so nervous, though, guys. You know,
I think you're pretending.
A consummate actually. Performance. So get on with it. Okay. Bye bye.
Somebody might be listening.
Lovely to have
you.
Yeah,
nobody's listening. Don't worry.
Thanks to the Sage of the Serenia, Terence Michaels, the Garden Keeper, Pete Maynard, and of course to you for your company. We're back next week with a travel special. With my very own brother Gavin Hogg talking about the lost kingdom of Lomantang on the Tibetan border. And Guy Hunter Watts, who's of course famous for great Andalusian walks, and a new book, which we will be offering a copy of in a first of the year competition. Oh, there's Bertie the Blackbird. Bye bye.